They're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha.
Yes, as mentioned in the last segment, they're really not coming to take him away, although although maybe they should. Let's hear from Dave Pakman on this.
There is an increasingly obvious and scary parallel between how President Donald Trump is being treated by his staff to how Trump's family reportedly treated his father, Fred Trump, during the later stages of his dementia. Earlier in the show, we played yet another one of these videos where Trump appears disoriented and left the swearing in of Tulsi Gabbard without swearing in Tulsi Gabbard. He just left. Everybody was left standing there like, wait a second, we're here to swear Tulsi Gabbard, and Trump just left. They didn't. And what's happening here is that history is repeating itself in really a pretty unsettling way. So let me break this down for you. First, Fred Trump was Donald Trump's father, real estate mogul, built the Trump family fortune, gave Trump the money he has now. But in his later years, Fred suffered from dementia. And according to reports, including accounts from Mary Trump, that's Donald's niece, the family did not necessarily handle it with the most grace. And one of the things that happened was that Fred Trump was reportedly set up in a fake office. And what I mean by fake office is the following. It was a real office structurally, okay? But there would be a desk, there would be a phone. He would be given papers to sign, sort of to go through the motions of you're doing stuff. When he would pick up the phone, he couldn't get an outside line. It would just ring through to his administrative assistant or whoever it was. He had no idea what he was signing. He was essentially a prop kept around to maintain the illusion of control. Now we fast forward to Donald Trump today. Yes, the speeches are often incoherent. He confuses names. He confuses places. He leaves events before the thing he's there to do has even taken place. But what I want to talk about here specifically is that Donald Trump is being handed these executive orders to sign on camera, and he seems to have no idea what is in them. He reacts to a lot of this stuff like it's the first time he has seen or heard of it. Here's one example.
Sir, next, this is an executive order relating to the use of paper straws. As you've consistently identified, nobody really likes paper straws.
Number one trending. Can you believe it? A paper straw was number one trending for 3 days or something.
The environmental impact of plastic straws versus paper straws is entirely unclear. This has cost both the government and private industry an absolute ton of money and left consumers all over the country wildly dissatisfied with their straws. So we're asking aspects of the federal government, federal departments and agencies to look at their existing procurement processes, and we're asking your domestic policy council to look holistically at this issue to address it, and it really is something that affects ordinary Americans in their everyday lives.
We're going back to plastic straws. These things don't work.
All right, so listen. I am not claiming that Trump doesn't understand what he is being given, but he often seems as surprised by what he's signing as some of the American people end up by what he is signing. Here is another example of this.
Next, in 2018, you imposed ad valorem duties tariffs on imports of steel at a 25% rate. Since that time, a large number of exclusions and exceptions to that tariff rule have been implemented. Because of the damage to the United States steel industry that those exceptions and exclusions have imposed, we're now, this order would reimpose that 25% ad valorem tariff rate on imports of steel, and it's presented for your signature now.
Okay. Do you understand what that means?
You sort of get the point. Trump just seems generally confused by this stuff. So here's the point that I'm trying to make. During his first term, Trump was notorious for signing executive orders without reading them. There were even reports that he didn't fully grasp the content of what he was signing. And now, of course, we have to ask, does this leave Trump open to being taken advantage of? And the answer seems to be a very obvious yes. If Trump is struggling to string together coherent sentences, how is he supposed to understand complex policy documents or even the implications of what he's signing? We know the answer. He doesn't understand them. And it is an eerie parallel to how Fred Trump was used as a puppet in his final years, signing whatever was put in front of him without really understanding it. Now, there is an important difference here. The difference is that Donald Trump is not just managing a family business. He's the president of the United States. Now, to be clear, I am not claiming that there is parity between Trump today and Fred Trump with advanced dementia, but the analogous circumstances of signing stuff he doesn't really understand is difficult to ignore. Cognitive decline or not, we are potentially heading into a situation where the Republican president is merely a figurehead and a puppet. And that should concern you regardless of your political affiliation, because when the person in the Oval Office doesn't fully understand the power they wield, it is not just a danger to democracy, it's a danger to the world. And we have a growing list of reasons to be worried about that. It's Trump signing the executive orders he doesn't seem to really understand or care about. It is that Trump has been supplanted, even quite literally in the Oval Office, by Elon Musk, as we saw yesterday. And it is Musk taking questions and Trump sitting there hunched over looking weak. It is the group of people around J.D. Vance, including his supporter Peter Thiel, who reportedly have the plan of taking over power for a feeble Donald Trump over the next 4 years to make Trump nothing but a figurehead. The people not concerned with this are the ones who think that they will get more access to power the more diminished Donald Trump ends up. And that should scare us. J.D. Vance is on that list. Elon Musk is on that list. And there's a lot of other people in Donald Trump's orbit. And the parallel to Fred Trump, not saying it's the same, is really difficult to miss here.
And we can't resist this little analysis by another commentator on Trump's mental status.
After Tulsi Gabbard was sworn in as the new director of national intelligence on Wednesday, Donald Trump spent an hour in the Oval Office doing a back and forth with reporters that were present, which, of course, is why reporters who are part of the White House pool have said that they're super excited about Trump being back because he loves to talk to them. You know, forget the horrific policies, the horrific people that were confirmed to cabinet positions just this week. Reporters love it because he'll sit there and just talk until he can't talk anymore. And that is exactly what he did on Wednesday. And as per usual, he descended into complete and total madness while ranting about magnets, which, of course, were not even a topic of conversation. Now, Donald Trump has long been an enemy of Big Magnet, I guess we'll call it. Back in 2024, just a year ago, he for some reason went on a tear and told us that magnets don't work if they're wet, which is why they're no good on boats. Which is completely not true. A magnet's going to work just as fine if it's wet or dry. But he told us, like, magnets don't work when they get wet, so you can't have them on a boat.
Anyway, we here at Radio Parallax tend to think that Trump's ideas on how well magnets work are equally matched by his ideas on how well tariffs work. He's apparently paused these lunatic tariffs he's going to put on Mexico and Canada, at least as we speak right now. It does appear that some of the sane adults in the business community have had a little chat with him, or at least the people around him. And for the moment, that bit of insanity is on hold. And the further good news in all of this is that not only are some of Trump's crazy ideas being put on hold, forces are being marshaled to counter what is going on. The group Anonymous has weighed in on this issue, and they can be a formidable adversary. I think that we've seen that. And let's hear what Anonymous has to say about current events.
Greetings, citizens of the United States. The effects of Donald Trump's presidency are no longer distant warnings. They are here, unfolding before you. While many remain unaware, blinded by the administration's relentless efforts to suppress the truth, the rest of the world is watching, and it is responding. Long-standing alliances with key nations such as Canada and Mexico are fracturing inch by inch. The cracks are widening, and the global community is reassessing its trust in the United States. The question is no longer if, but when these relationships will collapse entirely. The consequences will be severe. Every imported product you rely on, everyday essentials, food, technology, will see skyrocketing prices, making even basic necessities unattainable for the average American. What you perceive as a simple rise in costs is, in reality, a calculated strategy. The plan? To systematically dismantle the lower class, to push those already struggling into the abyss of poverty where they will face an impossible choice. Perish or submit to servitude under the wealthy elite. Make no mistake, this is economic warfare, and the target is you. The recent ICE raids are not just about immigration enforcement, they are about control. The Trump administration seeks to reignite the flames of racial inequality and segregation-era policies, erasing diversity to craft a nation built on division and fear. These operations are disrupting local economies, forcing businesses to crumble, and ensuring the economic elimination of the working class. What follows is a society engineered to serve the interests of the few at the cost of the many. And as the oligarchy takes shape, another darker ideology is creeping into the mainstream. Fascist ideals, once whispered in the shadows, are now being openly embraced. Symbolism matters. Gestures matter. Elon Musk, a figure of immense influence, recently tested the waters with a gesture recognized worldwide as a Nazi salute. This was not an accident. It was a message, a challenge, a warning. But know this, the people are not silent. Despite the administration's best efforts to muzzle dissent, the voices of resistance grow louder. Trump's reckless overhauls, his purges of experienced government officials, his chaotic restructuring of critical infrastructure have created vulnerabilities, weaknesses, entry points. This transition period is his greatest liability, but it is also our greatest opportunity. The rushed implementation of new systems, the mass firings of key personnel, and the chaotic dismantling of existing structures have left behind critical gaps. Gaps that Anonymous can and will exploit. Every system that has been hastily restructured without foresight, every official removed without proper transition planning, leaves behind exposed veins within the government's framework. These vulnerabilities are more than just bureaucratic inefficiencies. They are cracks in the foundation that can and will be breached. Anonymous watches. Anonymous waits. The time to act is fast approaching. The administration's arrogance blinds them to the fragility of their own system. Their overconfidence in their ability to silence dissent and erase opposition will be their undoing. We know where to look. We know how to strike. But understand this. Our intervention, no matter how disruptive, will only be a temporary roadblock unless you, the people, rise. This is your warning. This is your chance. The transition period is fleeting. And once they solidify their grip, your options will vanish. If you fail to act now, the cost of resistance will be far greater in the future. To those in power, think carefully. Your decisions now will determine your future. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
All right, we've got about half a segment left here before our hiatus, and I'd like to do some of our usual things. One thing we really like to do is talk about good news. Boy, could we use some of that. And for that, we're indebted to The Economist, which noted in its February 8th issue that there's some good news from India regarding India's tigers. To quote from the magazine, in India, images of tigers are everywhere. The apex predator is seen accompanying Hindu gods, and its face adorns political banners. Yet for most of the country's history, spotting the actual animal has become ever harder. Poaching, deforestation, and other human activity caused tiger populations to collapse from 40,000 at the beginning of the 20th century to fewer than 1,500 in 2006. But now, a recovery is afoot. Since 2006, the number of tigers in India has more than doubled to 3,680, according to a new study published in the journal Science. To which we say, bravo, India! And how about a good, bad, and ugly?
What the hell?
According to Week magazine, it was a good week last week, or maybe the week before that, for nicotine fiends, who may have representation at the highest levels of government. It's noted because apparently some sharp-eyed C-SPAN viewers did notice that RFK Jr.'s Senate confirmation hearings included little moments where he was apparently reaching into his pocket to discreetly slip nicotine pouches into his mouth. I guess this does represent progress for RFK. He used to be a heroin addict, and now he's just a nicotine addict. Of course, I do want to note in my experience as a physician that when I used to ask heroin addicts, which is easier to quit, heroin or nicotine, in this case cigarettes, in the vast majority of cases, they would say, oh, I can give up the heroin, but I can't stop smoking. I guess the same is true for our new Secretary of Health and Human Services. We would note that it was a bad week recently for generosity after Japanese police arrested a 71-year-old man who burgled 63 homes to fund his love of treating strangers to free meals and expensive sushi joints. Said Kazaroni Ignaki, I want it to look cool. And we would add it was an ugly week recently for the nation that leads the world in school shootings, with the news that a conservative appeals court ruled last week that 18 to 20-year-olds have the right to buy handguns. This struck down a federal ban in place since 1968. I'm sure that's going to produce some good outcomes. And speaking of trying to look cool, we'd have to add finally that it was both a bad and ugly week for trying to look cool if you're Elon Musk. Because apparently gamers are questioning how it is that Elon Musk has the time to become one of the world's best Diablo 4 players. Fortune magazine noted that avid gamer Musk first mentioned that he'd been ranked as one of the top 20 players in the Demon Slaying computer game during an appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast last November. Gamers believe that the ubiquitous tech titan couldn't have achieved this feat on his own, given the amount of time that mastery requires. Some contend that he surely hired more skilled players to grind through the more time-consuming parts of the game. Oh, that Elon. You know, it wasn't that long ago, Mr. McMillan, a few years back, that we would generally throw Elon Musk's name into this program because we thought he was kind of a goof and had a funny name. Who's laughing now? Not us. Now, we knew that Elon was very fond of polypharmacy, lots of drug use, but we didn't know that he was also a gamer, which makes us think even less of him. And although we can't exactly pin this one on Elon, we're not sure anything to do with it, but it does turn out that the Defense Department has now ordered NBC, NPR, Politico, and the New York Times to vacate their dedicated offices in the Pentagon. But don't worry, they'll be replaced. Replaced by three right-wing outlets, Breitbart, the New York Post, and One America News. Also, the Huffington Post, which did not have a Pentagon correspondent and did not even request a space. Said the Defense Department, the shift is part of a rotation program to broaden access. Speaking of the media, I wanted to put a plug in for Harry Shearer's Le Show. I don't listen to it all that often, but I did catch it last weekend and thought it was a pretty good effort. So we say, thanks for your good work, Harry. Now, someone who we think does not do a good job is the History Channel, which, to my great surprise, seems to be completely enamored with programs dealing with ancient aliens. But I have to say, they really outdid themselves with a little 8-minute piece that you can find on YouTube, and I don't recommend that you look for it. But it's a piece on the mystery of TWA Flight 800. During this 8 minutes of reporting, they failed to mention even once all of the witnesses who observed a missile rise up from sea level to strike the aircraft. Instead, they kept focusing on how it was there was clear evidence that the center fuel tank had blown up. Of course, if you fire off a missile and it explodes right next to the aircraft, somewhere near the center fuel tank, that might get things going. Instead, this incredibly disingenuous piece talked about how there's all this wiring. There's all this wiring inside the aircraft, and there's all this, you know, potential air-fuel mixer in an empty fuel tank, and, you know, undoubtedly somehow a spark ignited it. They can't say how. They still can't figure out exactly how, but by gosh, that's the answer. By the way, if you know anybody in aviation, and we hope you do, ask them about TWA Flight 800 and whether, if an aircraft, in this case the Boeing 747, had a design flaw in it that sometime caused it to explode in midair, ask them if they would not then see all of the aircraft and all the fleets of the world grounded until they fixed that problem. The answer you'll get, of course, is no, that's what would have happened if that's what really was the explanation. Now, when we come back and start doing this program on a more regular basis, which I hope happens, let's say in the summer, yours truly will be bringing on someone who was supposed to be on that flight on that day. She is a former TWA flight attendant. And as it happened, a friend of hers traded for that flight. We hope to speak to she and her husband about this, and I can assure you one thing, you're going to get a different perspective than what you're going to get from the History Channel. And, you know, you're also going to get a different perspective of what you heard here on Radio Parallax when we had Tom Stalkup and Christina Borgeson come on to talk about TWA Flight 800. They also have a documentary, which, to my great shock, I had never seen, because I believe it was produced after we had them both on the show, but it is quite excellent and also tells you a remarkably different tale of what is being said by the History Channel. And the thumbnail summary of this is that the United States military, the U.S. Navy, accidentally shot down a commercial jetliner. And because that's a very embarrassing and very expensive mistake, another story was concocted to explain the demise of the flight. It's not an explanation that is supported by the bulk of the evidence, and by the bulk of the evidence, I mean the bodies of the victims, photographic evidence of drones being shot out to sea, radar tracings, and myriad eyewitnesses in the air and on the ground who saw the missile rise up and strike the plane. Anyway, if you'd like to know more about it, we'd refer you back to our archives for our chats with both Tom Stalkup and Christina Borgeson. We talked to Christina more than once because she also produced some excellent books on the subject of the media and its failings. And while we're on hiatus, Mr. Miller, I think it'd be a good idea for that segment to get re-aired.
I think so, too.
Oh, and something else we absolutely do need to mention on this program here in February of the year 2025, that there's going to be a show in the sky late in this month where it will be possible to see Mercury, Venus, Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars by just looking up. If you have a pair of binoculars, you'll also be able to add Uranus to the list. And if you have a telescope, you'll be able to add Neptune to the list, which pretty much runs the table on the eight planets. And of course, the eighth planet I would mention, Earth, is really easy to spot.
For some people.
And speaking of astronomy, one thing we have failed to do, and we must apologize, is bring on some people from the B612 Society, which are concerned with preventing the Earth from being whacked by an asteroid, if we can possibly avoid it. And in some cases, it seems we might be able to possibly avoid it. But we've talked to those people. We know where they are in Mill Valley. And we expect in the future we will actually have a conversation with them. A conversation that takes on a little more importance in view of the fact that they've just now discovered another troublesome asteroid out there that might hit the Earth. As you may have already heard, the asteroid, which has been dubbed 2024 YR4, was first detected on the 27th of December of last year by an automated telescope in Chile, which is designed to scan for asteroids. And it's now at the top of NASA's impact risk list, with, at the latest estimate, about a 2% chance of colliding with the Earth in about 7 years. But hopefully you won't need to mark the 22nd of December 2032 as a red-letter day on your calendar, because as further measurements come in, it is hoped that they will decide, as has happened in the past, that actually, no, it's not going to hit us, at least not in 2032. By the way, in the cost-cutting run amok in the current administration, we do hope that they don't send the people trying to protect the Earth from asteroid collisions. And we hope they don't get their pink slips. And by the way, the asteroid Bennu, which we've sent out and retrieved samples from to take a good look at, made the news recently because they found some elements in it, some things in it that may represent building blocks for life, which, you know, that's not exactly a news item. We've known, we know that that's the case based on, you know, inspection of meteorites. But it is good to know all we can about Bennu, because it is a near-Earth asteroid and also might smack into the Earth in the next couple centuries. That's something well worth avoiding, because that's a big one. Of course, asteroid 2024 YR4 is not a slouch either. It's about 100 meters across. If that smacks into us, it's going to cause a bit of a stink, to quote from Dr. Strangelove, one of my favorite movies. And here's an item we just can't resist here on Radio Parallax. Do you know anybody that can wiggle his ears? I knew a guy back in high school that used to entertain us once in a while by making him flap. Well, according to New Scientist magazine, the useless muscle, and it is basically pretty useless, that allows some people to wiggle their ears, actually apparently activates when we strain to hear something. The magazine notes that our ape ancestors lost the ability to pivot their ears when they diverged from monkeys millions of years ago, but some of the muscles and brain neurons that underpin this trait remain in humans today. Many scientists have assumed that these so-called auricular muscles are obsolete, even if they do enable individuals to wiggle their ears. But in 2020, Daniel Strauss at Saarland University in Germany and colleagues found that they became activated in response to hearing sounds from different directions, prompting them to wonder whether this also happens when people are concentrating on listening. So to explore this, the researchers got 20 people with typical hearing to take three listening tests of varying difficulty. Then they used skin sensors to measure electrical activity in those auricular muscles. And what do you know? In the trickiest hearing tests, it turned out that the largest auricular muscle became most activated. Said researcher Strauss, it's pretty amazing to see this nearly forgotten muscle working so hard during effortful listening. Well, they think this research may help them develop better hearing aids, which aim to minimize listening strain. We hope so.
What was that?
Now, as alluded to briefly earlier in the show, we note that we didn't watch the Super Bowl. Now, as it turns out, Mr. Moon would only watch a Super Bowl under extreme duress.
Gunpoint.
But I've seen quite a few of them in my time, especially when they involve the San Francisco 49ers. But I was very, very happy to skip this one. Now, the recent upsurge in gambling across this country has got a lot of people looking at the NFL and wondering whether it's all in the up and up, particularly because some think that there's been some favoritism shown to the Kansas City Chiefs. And if the Chiefs had won that Super Bowl in one of these Hollywood scripted type, you know, squeakers, I would have been very suspicious. But what do you know? They got the crap beaten out of them, which at this point is okay with this correspondent. There was also a bonus in avoiding the Super Bowl in avoiding all of the ads that go with the Super Bowl. The fact that people who don't even enjoy football will watch the game for the commercials, I think says a lot about our society, and they're not good things being said. And that halftime show, God, I'm so relieved I missed it in its entirety. Although I did catch a comedian making fun of all of the dance moves that were up there on the stage and doing a brilliant job of it, but I can't find the video. But by God, Mr. Millen, that search must go on. And I guess lastly, back in the day, I was a very big fan in its early incarnations of Saturday Night Live, which celebrated its 50th anniversary this past week. I did not watch the commemorative documentaries that are looking back over the 50 years because, well, I liked it in the beginning, and I liked it in the 80s when they had the Phil Hartman, John Lovitz, Dana Carvey, Jan Hooks, Mike Meyer, Kevin Nealon crew. I thought they were the best. Some years later, I caught a sketch with Will Ferrell going on and on and on and on, never getting to be funny, which seems to be, from what I can see, what the show has descended into. But that's just me throwing out an opinion as if it carries any weight, which ultimately it probably doesn't. But another anniversary to be noted is the fact that, Mr. Millen, we've been doing this for 25 years as of this month.
Jesus.
Which I guess allows me to note that this program, like all of them for the past 25 years, have been produced by Mr. Edward McMillan. Yay. Who knows, he does not have to fear being replaced by AI, because this correspondent would rather drink poison than employ AI. All right, in closing, we would note that we all need to stay on our game, and we, you know, want to thank all the people that we've had on for the past quarter century and do hope to bring you more in the not-too-distant future. Our thanks to radio station KDVS for keeping us on the air for the past, well, 22 years. Or is it 23?
Who's counting?
And thanks to Guy Tortorisi, who's in the booth right now, putting this out on the terrestrial airwaves. Thanks, Guy. And by the way, if any of you out there know anybody working in Anonymous, well, give them a pat on the back for us, will you? I'm Douglas Everett, looking forward to some regularly scheduled programming in the not-too-distant future. We'll see you then.